Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Yale professor Jason Stanley, is out with a new book that he calls A Global Call to Action for Those Who Wish to Preserve Democracy in the U.S. and Abroad Before It's Too Late. In Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future, Jason Stanley pulls examples from Nazi Germany, colonized Kenya, and the Jim Crow South, as well as contemporary Hungary, India, and Israel, to lay out the playbook Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans are using to erase history and attack the education system. If Trump can control education, he can control the historical record, which is key to instituting an authoritarian regime. Jason Stanley writes, "If we are to stop the United States' drift toward fascism, we must recognize the nature of the challenges facing our educational institutions. Schools and universities are indeed on the front lines of the multi-decade far-right effort to reinforce anti-democratic myths and ultimately to transform a flawed but hopeful liberal democracy into an authoritarian, potentially fascist nation state." So what can we learn from history about what it takes to stop this? Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of 6 books, including How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and How Propaganda Works. His latest book is Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. The course that pulled his latest book together was not taught at Yale. It was a course on colonialism and fascism taught at the Kyiv School of Economics in the summer of last year, the second summer of Russia's war on Ukraine, in 8 consecutive multi-hour lectures, 2 of which had to be held in a bomb shelter. Jason Stanley writes about authoritarianism, democracy, propaganda, free speech, and mass incarceration for many publications, including the New York Times and The Guardian. Hi, Professor Stanley. Thanks so much for your work, and thank you for joining us again.
Oh, it's so great to be in conversation with you, even about these grim topics.
Well, very grim, Professor Stanley. And I want to start off with the big picture, because the election is in just 40 days. And I feel like many in the major media are still trying to normalize Trump and are not doing enough to give us the big picture. So given all the work that you do on fascism and authoritarianism, can you tell us what is at stake in this presidential race?
Yeah, I mean, the United States is already a deeply flawed democracy, and so much so that many Republicans claim we're not a democracy, but or they say a republic, which is a certain kind of democracy. So that's nonsense. So what we face is a kind of explicit, move to saying we're just not a democracy. We're going to have minority rule forever. If you look at the states, many states, you can see, like North Carolina, there are more registered Democrats than registered Republicans, but there's a supermajority of Republicans in the state legislature. And every time a Democratic governor is elected, they just strip him of all his power. So we're looking for one party rule in perpetuity. We're looking for what we let happen in many states happen at the national level. If you look at states where this has happened, like Tennessee, abortion is illegal even in cases of rape and incest. This is the kind of near-term future that we're facing. In Florida, university professors can't criticize the governor. This sort of thing is what is at stake.
You also write that in the years since Trump's defeat in the 2020 election, his fascist tendencies have only grown more extreme. He has, for instance, suggested suspending the Constitution's individual protections, called for drug dealers to be executed, mused about plans to prosecute his political rivals and investigative journalists for treason, said that some migrants are not people, and promised a bloodbath. And then we can talk about Project 2025. So given all of this, Professor Stanley, it's one thing to advocate and vote for more tax cuts for the rich, for deregulation, for the things that Republicans have fought for decades. But this goes so much further. Why do you think, and in many publications, of course, it is getting attention, but you're hearing things like, what is Trump's housing policy? But what about these fascist tendencies?
Well, you're feeling, you can take I feel, the mainstream media, the New York Times, they are just preparing themselves for an autocratic future where they have to line up or they'll get punched in the face by the president. They're not just normalizing, they're actively, you know, hiring people, you know, putting people, they're actively searching to, right, I mean, they're actively searching, I think it's just a speculation because they're afraid, but they're actively searching for a narrative where this, yeah, I mean, they're actively normalizing, and history will judge them, of course, if history isn't written by Trump and his autocratic successors. So, you know, the question of why say the New York Times and other mainstream media are so cowardly, well, I think they're scared. And the whole point of authoritarianism is to intimidate people into normalizing the system. And that's what we have happening at every level. That's what we have in schools and universities. We have an atmosphere of total fear. People don't seem to realize what's going on in southern states, the vilification of public school teachers and libraries, the vilification of LGBTQ Americans, who in many cases, LGBTQ families have to flee north, leave southern states like Florida. And then the active targeting of companies on political grounds, like obviously the major example is DeSantis and Disney. But that's just a straightforward authoritarian muscling of the public sphere to force assent. And Trump, we know from a recent New York Times investigative journalist report, that was very good. So their investigative journalists are still doing some work here. That Trump did successfully bring the Justice Department to target his foes with expensive lawsuits and such like. And, you know, that's what Orban does. Orban, unlike Trump's friend Putin, doesn't assassinate journalists and throw them out of windows or incarcerate all opposition or anyone mumbling any opposition for decades in miserable prisons. What Orban does is he uses the courts to tangle people in lengthy civil fines. And so I suspect Orban is the person they're trotting out as the model. So I suspect that's gonna happen, like just endless civil lawsuits, endless legal fees, well, endless investigations of his opponents that will bankrupt them in legal fees. So that's what we face. It's kind of boringly normal. Yeah.
Well, and since you brought up Orban, I'm still shocked in many ways that CPAC had their conference in Hungary in May of 2023, and then Orban visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago this last July. And yes, of course, it got media attention, but I was just surprised that it just didn't get more debate. And why is this happening? And what does this mean? And why are our conservatives openly embracing Viktor Orban taking their conservative conference to Hungary?
It's even worse than that. I was recently in Tennessee, and Justin Jones, who along with Justin Pearson was one of the two Tennessee state representatives who was expelled from the Tennessee legislature before being reinstated. Justin Jones approached me when we met. His first question was, what do you know about the Danube Institute? Now, the Danube Institute is Viktor Orban's think tank. And it turns out the Tennessee State Legislature had passed a resolution honoring the Danube Institute for, among other things, raising salience of the persecution of Christians worldwide. But the resolution, Justin Jones, there's a speech by him, there's an interchange between him and the Speaker of the House, where he asked the Speaker of the House, do you know who Viktor Orban is? And the Speaker of the House said, no. And then he said, why? And then Representative Jones said, why then are you passing a resolution praising his think tank? The resolution itself, I've shown it to Hungarian friends, it could only have been written by someone in the Danube Institute, because it contained information about the funding structure of the Danube Institute, praising some of the main funders that none of my contacts in Hungary actually knew. So the country of Hungary is writing legislation for the Tennessee state legislature. So, you know, I intended to write about that. I haven't yet, but it goes so much deeper than people realize. And this is a small European, poor European country that's a kleptocratic autocracy where government contracts go to the autocratic leader's friends. And I'm a patriotic American, and I don't want my country to be dominated by some Eastern European, petty autocrat. But that is, in fact, what's happening.
You write a lot in your book about Hungary. I mean, we learn so much in here. You wrote about a new curriculum in Hungary under Viktor Orban, which presents past far-right Hungarian nationalist leaders as heroes, minimizing or entirely omitting their support for anti-Semitic legislation and practices. In May 2022, Orban reorganized his administration to place education under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of the Interior, which is responsible for maintaining order through law enforcement. And Professor Stanley, when we've done a bunch of shows on Project 2025, we're doing a series, and a lot of our guests who study it very closely say, the problem is a lot of Americans think, oh, that can never happen here. But in fact, they say it could happen here. So can you talk about this? Because people look at what's going on in Hungary, and they might think, ah, that will never happen in the United States.
It's kind of hallucinatory that people think that, because it's happened in many states already in the United States. We have little Hungaries all across the United States, places where public school teachers are afraid, where books are banned. Hungary dropped Imre Kertész from their national curriculum. He's the only Hungarian Nobel Prize winner in literature since the Second World War, a Jewish Holocaust survivor. So they dropped him and they put in these very minor Hungarian nationalists from the 20s and 30s who no one would regard as serious writers as required in the curriculum. It's exactly parallel to what they're doing with Toni Morrison in many states today, who is a very banned author. They're taking, it seems to be playbook to take the a major figure from the persecuted historically persecuted non-dominant group, Jews in Hungary, Black Americans, and remove their perspective from the schools by targeting their Nobel Prize winners. So wow. The parallels are kind of eerie here. But, you know, in many cases, when you look at many U.S., in many cases of our states, it's worse than Hungary. I mean, let's be clear. There is no problem of voter fraud in the United States of America. Mm. And every single politician, maybe not Ron Johnson, but almost all the politicians like Ted Cruz, Ron DeSantis, know this. Ron DeSantis has created an office to hunt down supposed voter fraud, which is non-existent, and intentionally is raising terror among minority voters of being arrested. There is no voter fraud is like 0.0003%. It happens. So it is the Republican Party is based now on an entirely fictional problem that graduates of Yale and Harvard, like Ron DeSantis, like Tom Cotton, like J.D. Vance, who also endorsed the voter fraud, the election is stolen narrative in the New York Times in a hagiographic interview about how amazing he is, by Ross Douthat. He endorsed the voter fraud claim. And, he's not just a Yale Law School grad. The Yale Law School has his photograph hanging on the walls. These guys know that they're lying their heads off, and they're lying their heads off in order to restrict voting and go back to essentially the time in America where Black voters were too scared to vote. Mm. So, this is in some respects worse than Hungary, and we just let it happen.
Today, we're spending the hour with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University. We're talking about his latest book, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Stanley, we'd love to hear from you. His book pulls examples from Nazi Germany, colonized Kenya, the Jim Crow South, and then contemporary Hungary, India, and Israel to lay out the playbook that Trump and MAGA Republicans are using to attack the education system and erase and rewrite history. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. 40 days until the election, and so much is at stake. Professor Stanley, in your latest book, you expose the dangers of the authoritarian right's attacks on education and efforts to erase history. And yet you hear a lot of media outlets still calling all of this culture wars. And I really appreciated this piece you wrote last year in The Guardian, February, called Banning Ideas and Authors is Not a Culture War. It is fascism. What happens when the media calls this a culture war rather than saying that it's the right who are doing this? As far as I know, Democrats are not banning books. And as far as I know, Democrats are not trying to rewrite slavery.
Oh, that's that's right. So so you have this. I mean, there's a little bit of this false equivalence between quote unquote wokeness, which they're using essentially as far right regimes everywhere use Marxism, like, oh, you know, they're restricting speech. But then the very same people who are condemning quote unquote wokeness, some of which has excesses, are explicitly passing laws to ban books and remove books from public libraries and police professors and students. Tennessee has an online reporting form where you can report your professor for talking about divisive concepts, like supposedly divisive concepts like structural racism or white privilege. So in other words, if a professor teaches about redlining, that Black Americans couldn't get housing loans for many years, and that until the 70s, and if they lived in Black neighborhoods, largely Black neighborhoods, and that prevented generational wealth from accruing. That looks like it's illegal to teach, and that fact is illegal to teach in the University of Tennessee. And whatever you think of the excesses of wokeness, there's none of quote-unquote wokeness. There's nothing like that that is on par with what's happening in schools and universities. The initial claim was that students were making each other feel nervous about expressing conservative views. Bear in mind, this is in universities where that produced J.D. Vance, Ted Cruz, etc. I don't think they felt any hindrance to expressing their views. But the justification is supposedly like, oh, they're chilling speech. The progressives are chilling speech on campus. Therefore, we're going to fire teachers, fire professors who talk about facts. We're going to possibly subject them to civil penalties. We're going to fire teachers or possibly subject them to criminal penalties for teaching LGBTQ perspectives. And we're going to encourage everyone from families of small children on up to university students to turn in their teachers and professors like under communism. So the idea that this legal structure that's being erected and directed against public school teachers and professors, and it's worse than the Red Scare now. It's already well worse than the Red Scare. The idea that this is the same as some progressive students criticizing you for, you know, not being sufficiently critical of Israel, say, is a level of absurdity and hypocrisy that rivals, that is just, you know. And then to get to media complicity, the New York Times, its op-ed section is solely devoted to raising hysteria about leftists on campus, which is precisely what feeds into these laws that allow that, you know, oh, we're, it's justified to ban books, to remove LGBTQ perspectives, to claim, as the Nazis did, that LGBTQ perspectives are obscene. And that this is what it's straight out of Vladimir Putin's Russia, the 2013 Gay Propaganda Act. This is what we're seeing. So there's absolutely no comparison here. Even if you think there are excesses of wokeness, that quote unquote wokeness, that I do, I think everyone should recognize that. The idea that justifies this legal regime of hunting down professors and teachers and banning books from public libraries and schools, people should feel ashamed of themselves for being complicit in this kind of justification.
So given all that you laid out, why do you think Donald Trump has made it this far? We keep hearing every day that this race is so close. Who has any idea if these polls are correct? But we know that he's going to get tens of millions of votes. So what do you think explains this?
I think it's likely he will win. And if so...
You think it's likely he'll win?
I think it's likely he'll win. And I hope, and you know, unless there's substantially more mobilization, I'm certainly going to lend my voice to the explaining the dangers if he wins. But I think that you know, it's the moderates, it's the media, it's the mainstream media. History will look back and look at the moderates who joined in the panic about universities, which feeds right into these far-right narratives. So you know, what happened last year on campuses? Well, let's look, you know, this is why it's important to look internationally. In India, in 2019, after the passing of the Citizenship Amendment Act, which made Muslims second-class citizens, I can explain that. I won't explain that here. But there were large-scale nonviolent protests in universities. These protests were represented as anti-Indian and anti-national and attacks on India. And there were harsh crackdowns with militarized police. And the mood of the country was directed against the students as if they were supporting Muslim terrorism. Something similar has happened here. So we had anti-war protests, as there's always been in universities. And, you know, university presidents who called militarized police in were rewarded. What originally was a Fox News narrative that anti-war protests that had Jewish students as central participants were, in fact, pro-Hamas protests, you know, Hamas being, you know, a horrific terrorist organization. So this kind of misrepresentation justified militarized attacks on anti-war protests in universities. And who is at fault for that? Well, the New York Times, well, the mainstream media, who did misrepresent these protests. So what we have is we have already prepared militarized responses to student protests. We have already justified the far-right narrative that, you know, Yale University is filled with Marxists and radicals, which is the most absurd comment and viewpoint imaginable. It's like saying Yale University is filled with pink bunny rabbits who fly. So the mainstream media has completely justified this far-right narrative. So I would say the blame is, as Martin Luther King said, the white moderate, legitimizing this. Martin Luther King said that about barriers to the civil rights movement.
I just want to ask you again, Professor Stanley, do you think that Donald Trump, that Kamala Harris might win, but Trump will win the Electoral College?
I think it's likely, but certainly not certain, that Donald Trump will win.
Right.
Of course.
It just depends on how many people vote, and there's so many factors involved.
And the Trump Supreme Court, like any autocratic regime, it's filled with justices who will do anything in their power and beyond their power to make sure Trump wins and no Democrat ever wins again. So everybody knows this. it's a color by numbers playbook of every autocratic regime ever. And, and this is what has happened to our legal system. The lifelong appointed justices are hellbent on Donald Trump winning, regardless of anything legal. So, they set the law. So, we saw this with Bush versus Gore in 2001. But this is going to be that on steroids. So Kamala Harris has to win in such a way that the Supreme Court can't overturn her victory.
Right. Win in huge numbers. Today we're speaking with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University. His latest book is called Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. He says his new book is a global call to action for those who wish to preserve democracy in the U.S. and abroad before it is too late. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of the new book, Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Jason Stanley pulls examples from Nazi Germany, Kenya, and the Jim Crow South, and contemporary Hungary, India, and Israel to lay out the playbook Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans are using to attack the education system and erase history. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Stanley, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Maya in Oakland. Hi, Maya. Thank you for holding. Hi, do we have Maya? Oh, I think we dropped Maya. Professor Stanley, Maya wanted to point out that the execution yesterday in Missouri is another example of how history is getting rewritten. I hope you can call us back, Maya, to tell us more about this. Have you been following this case, Professor Stanley?
Marcellus Williams?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, of course. It's another innocent. It looks like it's another innocent person who is executed by Southern State, which is, of course, a familiar story in American history. We're an absolutely brutal prison society. There are more people now in serving life sentences in the United States than were in prisons and jails when I was born. And that was the response to the civil rights movement. The response to the civil rights movement was to build a massive prison system and change the debate from racial equality to crime, and then build a massive prison system to incarcerate mostly black people's parents, so they with brutally long sentences. So yeah, I mean, this is a reign of terror directed against, but it's American history. I mean, the idea that this ended, that there was like a full stop of this, it's unimaginable that there would be a full and complete stop of racial terror in the United States. So we have a return of these practices. I've heard people describe what happened to Marcellus Williams as a lynching. And I don't know as many of the facts as other people, but if he was innocent, it was a lynching. And it looks like, many people think he was. So, we incarcerate the most, we have more people incarcerated than any country in the world. And until El Salvador recently had their autocratic president, we had the highest incarceration rate in the world, and every U.S. state had a higher incarceration rate than any other democracy. So
And this is something that both parties are deeply complicit in. The Clintons, of course, were deeply complicit in mass incarceration, as was Joe Biden. So all of these are fascist. I encourage people not to ask themselves the question, is America a democracy? Is America a fascist state? Of course, America is not a fascist state. You can still have radio programs like this. However, we have many fascist practices like mass incarcerating our formerly enslaved population. And also even white men have an enormously high incarceration rate because of the costs of this. But this is wiped from our schools. The concept of mass incarceration itself is fairly novel. And the very books that, you know, the books are banned that study it. And Trump is promising more fascist practices, and people will shift this to the argument, oh, the United States isn't a fascist country yet. It's not Putin's Russia. And I doubt we ever will be as bad as Putin's Russia, where journalists are thrown from windows and everyone faces, as I said, everyone, you know, it's just, you know, any kind of opposition voice, you're thrown in prison or killed. I doubt we will reach that point, but Trump is promising a lot of fascist practices. Both parties have engaged in, you know, vicious demagoguery on crime, but now crime is at its historically lowest levels. I was reading a New York Times article a few months ago that said in July, Boston had only had 4 murders. Of course, 1 murder is too much, but, you know, we have crime is at historically low levels, and Donald Trump is running a campaign saying that crime is out of control. So Trump is promising that all of these aspects of American society, he's going to make America great again. He's going to bring back these practices of just, you know, brutal incarceration. And he's promising massive concentration camps for immigrants and a Gestapo-like search through American cities for immigrants that I think we can expect can in some way, shape, form, or manner be extended to his political opponents.
Well, thank you for the call, Maya. We're going to do a show about the death penalty soon. Amnesty International reports that within the next 4 weeks, there are 8 scheduled executions in the United States. Close to 3/4 of the countries around the world have now abolished the death penalty in law or practice. The United States is not on that list. Instead, it's on a list of countries that still implement the death penalty, including China, Saudi Arabia, and Somalia. So thank you for the call. If you'd like to join us with Professor Stanley, we're talking today about his new book, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Professor Stanley, another question about Donald Trump. Since he decided to run for office for president, we're seeing so many more Trumpists. I mean, they call this Trumpism. Project 2025 basically says it's not conservatism, it's Trumpism. There are a lot of young people out there who are also Trumpists. What are your thoughts about this? What happens if Donald Trump loses? What happens to this authoritarian wing of, well, it now is the new Republican Party?
Yeah, so I think everybody's seen that. Let's not forget it's a kleptocracy. So if you look at, it's an autocratic kleptocracy. So, you know, if you look at Florida, DeSantis is placing his buddies and supporters into plum public positions to get salaries, like the head of New College of Florida. He's using the public positions. It looks like he's using public positions to enrich his supporters and friends. So, you know, it's a kleptocratic autocracy. I think in Trump's first term, it was a kleptocratic autocracy. And I think that people are seeing, opportunities in this. I think the billionaire class, this is just utterly standard for this autocratic structure, fascist autocratic structure. The billionaire class sees that they, you know, hopes that they can get a leg up on the competition by cozying up to the ruling party. So I expect, you know, I expect, first of all, as with all autocratic systems, there's going to be a struggle over who the successor is. Now we have J.D. Vance is like an intellectual of the far right, of the authoritarian right, you know, with an agenda mainly, you know, directed towards women's bodies, restricting women's freedoms, getting them to have more babies, that sort of thing. So I expect a kind of one-party Christian nationalist party backed by cynical billionaires who just want to exploit the rubes to get their taxes cut and to get regulations cut and to give them a leg up around their competition who forgot to support Trump. And so this combination of business elites, cynical politicians who went to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, like Ted Cruz, Ron DeSantis, J.D. Vance, Tom Cotton, Elise Stefanik, all of whom went to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, most of whom went to both, two of those three institutions. So these politicians, these cynical politicians who know perfectly well there's no voter fraud, it's all about power. And so they're unifying with the Christian nationalists. I think someone like J.D. Vance is a Christian nationalist and also an elite Yale grad and not sort of an elite Yale grad and backed by billionaires like Peter Thiel. So I just expect the United States to become a one-party state like so many southern states, like North Carolina, you know, gerrymandered so that a minority of voters, of Republican voters, control everything with a 9-0, with a Supreme Court that backs that one party. And that is totally normal. And, you know, that's just a lot of countries are like that. Will they allow us to elect a president again who isn't of that party? Well, in North Carolina, they allow you to elect a Democratic governor. He doesn't have any power. So who knows the exact shape it will take. I doubt it will become as violent except to immigrants, where I think the violence will be unspeakable. Unfortunately, both parties are complicit in this. But I think it's just going to get like extreme. And I think the Republican Party will just institute what they want to institute. Their doctrine is that if you're not a Republican, you're a Marxist traitor. And so it's like somehow traitorous to have the other party have any power. And that's a one-party state. And that's what we see in many states already. So a one-party state, not because the majority of voters want that, but because we have extreme gerrymandering that allows no other solution. The Republican Party has long wanted permanent minority rule, as they see a future where progressive policies are popular and progressive parties and politicians will increasingly become more popular. And they want to cut that off before that happens. It's normal. It happens. Democracy is really hard. You've got to protect democracy. We've been doing a terrible job of it. Just look at, you know, North Carolina, Tennessee, Mississippi. When I tell people in Europe that Mississippi's population is over 30% black, they cannot believe it because black Americans have so little power in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So, I think, you know, it will be a one-party state with billionaire-backed one party that delivers Christian nationalism to most of the nation. And, you know, the leaders, their kids go to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton and get supported by the government in their financial endeavors.
This is all pretty bleak, Professor Stanley. We've got a few emails saying thank you for your work. What can be done about this?
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it would be, there's a lot to be done. First of all, there's like a lot of grassroots stuff to be done, organizing, voting, preparing, protecting the vote. We have to have, you really need to help people who are registering voters. You need to do everything you can on the local level to protect this vote that's coming up. And we need to protect our local institutions. The MAGA Republicans have a very clear sense that, you know, the local, of the importance of the local. So we need to support our public school teachers. We need to support our public schools. We need to support our libraries. There's a lot of mass vilification and social media attacks happening directed against public school teachers, against election workers, and you need to show solidarity with people being attacked. Authoritarianism thrives on fear, and if everyone's afraid of being targeted, then authoritarianism is going to win. So if your neighbor is being targeted for, you know, teaching a book that represents same-sex couples, so kids of such couples don't feel, freakish, then, and they're singled out as like a groomer or a pedophile, protect them. Like say, this is ridiculous. All they were doing was they wanted this book to be taught so LGBTQ students feel better. So go on the local level, protect the things that are being attacked, the public schools, the universities. United States has the best university system in the world. Everyone sends their kids here. We're unilaterally destroying it now. Mm-hmm. So raise alarm about this on the local level. Right now, really organize voter registration. The Republicans have in many southern states put severe barriers against voter registration groups. Everyone's got to chip in. I think there's a lot of people who are not going to be persuadable. They see their agendas are going to be fulfilled by Trump. Christian nationalists, I don't think, are persuadable. Do the work of registering people. If everyone votes, then democracy wins.
To your point about education, and I'd love to have you back so we can dive more into your book. You write that an education system is the foundation upon which a political culture is built. Authoritarians have long understood that when they wish to change the political culture, they must begin by seizing control of education. This has been going on for decades, of course, but now it is really heightened.
Yes, we have an atmosphere of total fear. The American Association of University Professors report on Florida. It's just like, you know, it's an atmosphere of total intimidation with, DeSantis allies and cronies filling every, important role. And tenure is essentially doesn't exist in the state of Florida. Indiana and Ohio are going to follow suit. It's as I said, I think it's a worse it's a worse situation than under the Red Scare and will be remembered as such. And all these representations of universities as, you know, Marxist, communist hotbeds of pro-terrorism, those are occurring in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And they're lies. You know, it took months for the New York Times to acknowledge that the anti-war protests against Israel's actions in Gaza had substantial participation from Jewish students. That took months for the New York Times to recognize. And so we've got, people have got to be stop becoming useful dupes for authoritarianism. And it's really worrisome to see all these people just facilitate this Fox News rhetoric directed against schools and universities. Support your local schools. The structure of what we're seeing is, you need, authoritarians thrive off of fear. So Plato long ago identified the tyrant by saying the tyrant is someone who presents himself as the protector of the people, spreads fear, sets the population against each other, tells the dominant group they have to be afraid of internal enemies, and says, I am your protector. So if anyone is like, I am your protector from all this crime and from other people in your communities, that's a tyrant. And you know, that's exactly from 2,300 years ago, Plato's Republic. So what a good education system and a democracy does is it gives you the tools to see beyond the stereotypes that create the fear. If you know Black history, if you know the history of the labor movement, if you are exposed to LGBTQ perspectives, the stereotypes of those groups won't have any effect on you, and you won't need to feel, you won't be conditioned to feel that fear. If you see history, the nation's history, as more than just the history of the dominant group, then you won't be conditioned to feel fear about immigration changing the makeup of the nation. It's only if you've been presented with this education that valorizes the dominant group and equates it with the greatness of the nation. You know, the white Christian male founders were the greatest men in history, and you know, the greatness of America is due to the exploits and accomplishments of its white leaders. Then you're going to be affected more by great replacement theory, the view that Democrats or Jewish people are bringing immigrants in to undermine the dominant group of white Christians. So we have to preserve Black history in our schools. We have to preserve labor history so people don't think unions are, you know, communist organizations. We have to preserve the history of LGBTQ perspectives so people don't think LGBTQ families are somehow a threat to their own, not heterosexual families. And if not, if we don't do those things, we face tyranny.
Well, Professor Stanley, thank you so much for joining us and for your work. We would love to have you back because we really just scratched the surface. I'd love to have you back, especially to talk about your family history. I loved the story you told about your grandmother. And then all of the other history you bring up about what we can learn from the Jim Crow South, from Nazi Germany, from present-day Hungary, Israel, and India. Thank you so much for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much, Rose. It's always great to be in conversation with you.
Thank you. Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of many books. His latest is Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. It is such an important book. Find more information, kalw.org, click news, and Your Call. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.